flyer, your brochure, that the theme is of the oceanographic nature. And I understand it's called Oceans of Possibilities, with the water and the ocean creatures and the boaters and so on. Where did that concept come from? Why'd you pick that?
There's a sort of like a national theme that you can take part in it. You can adjust it to your own self. But what we've done, yes, there are programs about oceans, say like the Great Lakes, but also we have besides the word possibilities, and that'll show up in some of the programs too.
Nice. Well, we know that this has officially kicked off this past month in June, and it is going strong through July and August as well. So if we think about events just sort of July and forward, I know that there are literally things that we could be doing every day, both at the library and at home through the conjunction of the library. But what are some of the things that you're highlighting? And tell us a little bit, I suppose, let's start more in the general terms, in terms of the concept of the Summer Reading Challenge. How formal does that have to be? Do we have to get very specific, or can it be just, I read an extra book this week? What's the process like?
Yeah, you can. It's approach. We have a program called Beanstack where you register and sign up and keep track of what you've read. And you could read by hours, or you could read by days. Whatever is comfortable with you. Now, I know, especially for the adults, it's hard to keep track of and just simply sit down after taking care of the kids and just simply sitting down, and that's okay. You can keep track of your reading by hours, or just simply say, hey, I read this thing. So it's pretty easy going. So it's to encourage people to take part in it, whether it's a little bit or a lot.
I think it's interesting that when I was a bit younger, we used to keep track by books. I read six books. I read three books. I read one book. I read a half a book. And I kind of like the fact that that's not the way it's being done in this situation, because I don't think you have to complete the book to feel that success that you contributed to the process of reading. Is that sort of the point there?
Yeah, we just want to, we don't want to be like, you must read. It's hard these days kids, yeah, naturally, they'll be great readers, and they can keep track of things. They have no problems. Well, adults may have a little trouble, maybe you'll spend the whole summer reading one book. That's fine, as long as you do, like, say, a chapter a day, if you have certain goals, like a chapter a day or something, and if you meet them, great.
Nice. Thank you. So let's dive in. Did you get the pun there? Let's dive in to the ocean. I know that was bad. But so getting specific, there are several different approaches here. I know, even on the sort of the weekly thing, even if we don't get into one specific event just yet, we've got the outdoor story time on Thursdays in the morning. You've got a film series on Monday evenings, the ready to read Monday mornings, and then even the get crafty things on Tuesdays. So those are things that are going on every single week that you can participate once or multiple times. Share a little bit of detail on some of those items there.
Well, the outdoor story time is great. We have on the west side of their building, Miss Michelle will be talking about, do a story and then a sing-along. It's very nice. We had the mayor stop by last week. And then the challenges are kind of ongoing. And also you can get with the challenges, you can take part in Puzzle Palooza, for instance, and also keep track of it on Beanstack. You'll get additional points for some of our prizes, which are gift certificates to Target. It'd be just additional entries, I should say. So it's a beneficial for you have fun, and you can maybe get a gift card.
Nice. Those film series that are taking place on Monday evenings, that is something that you will actually physically do at the Centennial Library, correct?
So in our auditorium, mm-hmm. We'll be showing movies we had Free Willy the other day. We have next week, of course, because of the holiday, we have no movie, but movies like We Bought a Zoo, The French Dispatch, The Tempest, really interesting stuff.
Nice variety there. It looks like most of the events are taking place at the Henry Ford Centennial Library. There.
Yeah, most of them.
And some at all the libraries.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like Lego Club, I believe, over at Esper, for instance.
Hmm. Very good. Yeah, and the Esper branch, we should mention, on Warren Road in Dearborn, and then the Bryant Library down a little bit farther on Michigan Avenue, also in Dearborn. So some nice opportunities. When we talk about these events, would you say percentage-wise, how many geared towards children, young adults, and then the adult population? How do you kind of divvy that up?
Well, of course, it's most of them are for kids, and then there are plenty for teens and stuff, and we have a fair amount of adult programs. We're not trying to leave anybody out.
I like that. In terms of some of the clever names here, Book and Cook, you have the book In a Pickle, and you're pickling vegetables. There's an Under the Sea dance party. There are Book and Cook events for teenagers with cashew chicken. It's just so clever, so creative. It must take an awful lot of time to put this stuff together. Do you find inspiration from people in the community saying, we'd like to try this, we'd like to try that? Or do you sort of come up with really original ideas and just sort of see how they play out? How does one program something of this intense nature?
Well, you probably, you would find inspiration, in the city, the surrounding, what people suggest. And then also sort of broaden the idea. Emphasize possibilities, like in doing in August on the 13th, I put together a program where we have a Paralympic start. Why a Paralympic, you say? The word possibilities. We play on the word possibilities. A lady who's a Paralympic swimmer will be giving a talk, and we may have more surprises in store for it that'll be very interesting for all ages. Why possibilities? Well, I just want to be encouraging. You hear all this. The world has a lot of problems these days, and if you can be encouraging, to find ways to be encouraging to people, I figure that would be, I think people would appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. It's a positive spin, positive slant on things that we could look at. It's that half glass, ocean half empty, ocean half full thing. And I like the half full approach that you've got and thinking about those possibilities.
Yeah, one of the children's program is creating your own book, I believe. Ooh. And again, it's using possibilities, creativity. Want to be positive, want to be encouraging. And that, I think that is something we could do to help people.
Yeah, No doubt that there is plenty of support to assist people that want to continue to learn throughout the summer season, as well as those who just want to have some fun. Dan, this is a fantastic series of events you've got going on, and really, it just literally looks like something every day. Certainly too many to mention here. If we have interested listeners that want to get do sort of a deep dive, there's another another little play on words there, into the programming, whether it's for a book club event or crafting or math or puzzles or, you know, an under-the-sea dramatic play that I'm reading about here. Just fascinating. What's the best place to get this information, and do we need to register for all these things?
Well, no. DearbornLibrary.org. We have links to the summer reading flyer. And that'll tell you if you need to register for some of the programs, or you can just simply show up.
Great. DearbornLibrary.org. That's fantastic. In terms of the amount of people that it takes to put on events like this, do you have a separate dedicated staff with the library? Because I know, aside from all of this going on, there will be just regular library services available, as there usually are. So it seems like it's going to be sort of an all hands on deck kind of a situation. I had to throw in that last pun, but do you get volunteers to help with this, or are there students that are involved in handling
not these? At this time. We just have our regular children and adult staff putting together the programs and running them.
Wow. Well, that's a lot of work. I am grateful for your time in sharing the Oceans and Possibilities Summer Reading Challenge 2022 here at the Dearborn Public Library System, as well as the dedication of you and your entire staff and the entire Dearborn Public Library community for putting on these things. I kind of want to do that. Where is it? I'm very excited about this under the sea dramatic play. I might like to be involved in that, and then making dips and salsas late in another month sounds pretty fun too. So there's an awful lot going on, and it sounds like there really is something for everybody. Dan, basic services going well at the library aside from the summer reading program?
Oh, yes, yeah. We've gotten a lot of registrants so far. We're open here at Centennial 10 to 8 Monday through Thursday, and 10 to 5:30 on Fridays and Saturdays. And then the branches are open 11 to 7 on Monday and Tuesday, and 11 to 5:30 on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturdays.
Right. If someone doesn't have a library card but is interested in coming back after many years or coming out for the very first time, how do they go about taking care of that?
Well, just stop by any here at the main library or any of the branches. You can, at the circulation desk, we'll say, hey, my card's still valid, and we'll let you know. And if not, you can sign up if you bring your ID with you, if a city, and we'll set you up.
Right. Easy enough. It is Oceans of Possibilities at the Dearborn Public Library this season with their summer reading program. And it is reading, 3.0. It's so much more than just the reading part, but that certainly is where it all begins. It is a library after all. DearbornLibrary.org. DearbornLibrary.org is the place to locate additional information on this wonderful series of programs. Dan, we wish you and your team a wonderful summer, much success with this program. And if someone wanted to reach you directly to ask anything very specific, how might they do that, please?
Let's see. Probably my email, dlodge@ci.dearborn.mi.us.
All right. Fair enough. Dan Lodge, Librarian 1, Adult Services at the Dearborn Public Library. Lots of great information. So many things to do this summer season. So no reason to be bored. Absolutely. In this community. Dan, thank you for your time. I wish you a beautiful, safe, and happy summer season. And we look forward to checking in with you again.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. All the best. Dan Lodge joining us here on the WHFR Journal. My goodness, so much fun to be had at the Dearborn Public Library System this summer season. Again, for more information, dearbornlibrary.org. Susan McGraw here. We will return with more on the WHFR Journal. Stay with us.
Take your favorite non-commercial radio station with you wherever you go with the WHFR radio app, now available for free in the Google Play Store. After installing the app, you can listen to WHFR live to your Android device anywhere in the world. There are also articles posted by WHFR staff and the latest updates to the WHFR schedule. WHFR to go, free delivery, now available on the WHFR app and the Google Play Store.
You guys and dolls, join me, Daddy G, at the Malt Shop every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on WHFR.fm. The jukebox will be playing and we'll be spinning the platters from the 50s and 60s. So remember, that's the Malt Shop every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. Be there or be square.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, pleased to be with you this Friday afternoon. We'll continue on our hour together, expanding on the theme from our last interview, which, of course, is reading. Hopefully, you'll have some time this summer to sit back and enjoy a good book or three. I know I certainly have been and plan on doing that for some of the rest of the summer. And, of course, one of the hardest things of being an avid reader is figuring out exactly what to read. Now, we all have our favorite authors and genres that we tend to turn to time and time again. But like all things in life, sometimes it's good to push ourselves a little bit and get out of that comfort zone. To talk a little bit more about that subject as it relates to reading, we turn to a TED Talk from a woman named Anne Morgan. This comes from a TED Global conference in London, and the talk's entitled My Year Reading a Book from Every Country in the World. Anne Morgan considered herself well-read until she discovered a massive blind spot on her bookshelf. Amid a multitude of English and American authors, there were very few books from beyond the English-speaking world. So she set an ambitious goal to read one book from every country in the world over the course of an entire year. Now she's urging other English speakers to read translated works so that publishers will work harder to bring foreign literary gems back to these shores. Anne Morgan and her TED Talk, My Year Reading a Book from Every Country in the World, as we continue on today's WHFR Journal.
It's often said that you can tell a lot about a person by looking at what's on their bookshelves. What do my bookshelves say about me? Well, when I asked myself this question a few years ago, I made an alarming discovery. I'd always thought of myself as a fairly cultured, cosmopolitan sort of person, but my bookshelves told a rather different story. Pretty much all the titles on them were by British or North American authors, and there was almost nothing in translation. Discovering this massive cultural blind spot in my reading came as quite a shock, and when I thought about it, it seemed like a real shame. I knew there had to be lots of amazing stories out there by writers working in languages other than English, and it seemed really sad to think that my reading habits meant I would probably never encounter them. So I decided to prescribe myself an intensive course of global reading. 2012 was set to be a very international year for the UK. It was the year of the London Olympics. And so I decided to use it as my time frame to try and read a novel, short story collection, or memoir from every country in the world. And so I did. And it was very exciting. And I learnt some remarkable things and made some wonderful connections that I want to share with you today. But it started with some practical problems. Now, after I'd worked out which of the many different lists of countries in the world to use for my project, I ended up going with the list of UN-recognized nations, to which I added Taiwan, which gave me a total of 196 countries. And after I'd worked out how to fit reading and blogging about roughly 4 books a week around working 5 days a week, I then had to face up to the fact that I might not even be able to get books in English from every country. Only around 4.5% of the literary works published each year in the UK are translations, and the figures are similar for much of the English-speaking world, although the proportion of translated books published in many other countries is a lot higher. 4.5% 4.5% is tiny enough to start with, but what that figure doesn't tell you is that many of those books will come from countries with strong publishing networks and lots of industry professionals primed to go out and sell those titles to English language publishers. So, for example, although well over 100 books are translated from French and published in the UK each year, most of them will come from countries like France or Switzerland. French-speaking Africa, on the other hand, will rarely ever get a look in. The upshot is that there are actually quite a lot of nations that may have little or even no commercially available literature in English. Their books remain invisible to readers of the world's most published language. But when it came to reading the world, the biggest challenge of all for me was the fact that I didn't know where to start. Having spent my life reading almost exclusively British and North American books, I had no idea how to go about sourcing and finding stories and choosing them from much of the rest of the world. I couldn't tell you how to source a story from Swaziland. I wouldn't know a good novel from Namibia. There was no hiding it. I was a clueless, literary xenophobe. So how on earth was I going to read the world? I was going to have to ask for help. And so in October 2011, I registered my blog, ayearofreadingtheworld.com, and I posted a short appeal online. I explained who I was, how narrow my reading had been, and I asked anyone who cared to leave a message suggesting what I might read from other parts of the planet. Now, I had no idea whether anyone would be interested. But within a few hours of me posting that appeal online, people started to get in touch. Now, first it was friends and colleagues, and then it was friends of friends, and pretty soon it was strangers. 4 days after I put that appeal online, I got a message from a woman called Rafida in Kuala Lumpur. She said she loved the sound of my project. Could she go to her local English language bookshop and choose my Malaysian book and post it to me? I accepted enthusiastically, and a few weeks later, a package arrived containing not one, but two books. Rafida's choice for Malaysia, and a book from Singapore that she had also picked out for me. Now, at the time, I was amazed that a stranger more than 6,000 miles away would go to such lengths to help someone she would probably never meet. But Rafida's kindness proved to be the pattern for that year. Time and again, people went out of their way to help me. Some took on research on my behalf, and others made detours on holidays and business trips to go to bookshops for me. It turns out, if you want to read the world, if you want to encounter it with an open mind, the world will help you. When it came to countries with little or no commercially available literature in English, people went further still. Books often came from surprising sources. My Panamanian read, for example, came through a conversation I had with the Panama Canal on Twitter. Yes, the Panama Canal has a Twitter account. And when I tweeted at it about my project, it suggested that I might like to try and get hold of the work of the Panamanian author Juan David Morgan. I found Morgan's website and I sent him a message asking if any of his Spanish language novels had been translated into English. And he said that nothing had been published, but he did have an unpublished translation of his novel, The Golden Horse. He emailed this to me, allowing me to become one of the first people ever to read that book in English. Morgan was by no means the only wordsmith to share his work with me in this way. From Sweden to Palau, writers and translators sent me self-published books and unpublished manuscripts of books that hadn't been picked up by Anglophone publishers or that were no longer available, giving me privileged glimpses of some remarkable imaginary worlds. I read, for example, about the Southern African king, Gunganana, who led the resistance against the Portuguese in the 19th century, and about marriage rituals in a remote village on the shores of the Caspian Sea in Turkmenistan. I met Kuwait's answer to Bridget Jones. And I read about an orgy in a tree in Angola. But perhaps the most amazing example of the lengths that people were prepared to go to help me read the world came towards the end of my quest, when I tried to get hold of a book from the tiny Portuguese-speaking African island nation of São Tomé and Príncipe. Now, having spent several months trying everything I could think of to find a book that had been translated into English from the nation, it seemed as though the only option left to me was to see if I could get something translated from scratch. Now, I was really dubious whether anyone was going to want to help with this and give up their time for something like that. But within a week of me putting a call out on Twitter and Facebook for Portuguese speakers, I had more people than I could involve in the project, including Margaret Jewel Costa, a leader in her field who has translated the work of Nobel Prize winner José Saramago. Now, with my 9 volunteers in place, I managed to find a book by a São Tomean author that I could buy enough copies of online. Here's one of them. And I sent a copy out to each of my volunteers. They all took on a couple of short stories from this collection, stuck to their word, sent their translations back to me, and within 6 weeks, I had the entire book to read. In that case, as I found so often during my year of reading the world, my not knowing and being open about my limitations had become a big opportunity. When it came to São Tomé and Príncipe, it was a chance not only to learn something new and discover a new collection of stories, but also to bring together a group of people and facilitate a joint creative endeavor. My weakness had become the project's strength. Now, the books I read that year opened my eyes to many things. As those who enjoy reading will know, books have an extraordinary power to take you out of yourself and into someone else's mindset, so that, for a while at least, you look at the world through different eyes. That can be an uncomfortable experience, particularly if you're reading a book from a culture that may have quite different values to your own. But it can also be really enlightening. Wrestling with unfamiliar ideas can help clarify your own thinking. And it can also show up blind spots in the way you might have been looking at the world. When I looked back at much of the English language literature I'd grown up with, for example, I began to see quite how narrow a lot of it was compared to the richness that the world has to offer. And as the pages turned, something else started to happen too. Little by little, that long list of countries that I'd started the year with changed from a rather dry academic register of place names into living, breathing entities. Now, I don't want to suggest that it's at all possible to get a rounded picture of a country simply by reading one book. But cumulatively, the stories I read that year made me more alive than ever before to the richness, diversity, and complexity of our remarkable planet. It was as though the world's stories and the people who'd gone to such lengths to help me read them had made it real to me. These days, when I look at my bookshelves or consider the works on my e-reader, they tell a rather different story. It's the story of the power books have to connect us across political, geographical, cultural, social, religious divides. It's the tale of the potential human beings have to work together. And it's testament to the extraordinary times we live in, where, thanks to the internet, it's easier than ever before for a stranger to share a story, a worldview, a book, with someone she may never meet on the other side of the planet. I hope it's a story I'm reading for many years to come, and I hope many more people will join me. If we all read more widely, there'd be more incentive for publishers to translate more books, and we would all be richer for that. Thank you.
Anne Morgan and her TED Talk, My Year Reading a Book from Every Country in the World. It was given at a TED Global Conference in London. I'm Alan Mazurek. This is the WHFR Journal. I'll be with you until 2 o'clock today. Kitty Love coming up at that time with a trip down Highway 61. We'll be back with more on today's WHFR Journal in just a moment. We do hope you'll stick around.
We're back. That's right. Metro Detroit Youth Day is back, and this year's event is going to be better than ever. There will be celebrity guest appearances, games and prizes, live entertainment, sports clinics, lunch for kids ages 8 to 15, and so much more. And it's all free. It all begins Wednesday, July 13th at Belle Isle Park in Detroit. To register, call the Michigan Youth Appreciation Foundation at 586-774-4000 or log on to Metro Detroit Youth Day.org.
Up next on the WHFR Journal, we turn our attention to Washington, D.C. and the United States Supreme Court and one of their recent decisions. No, not that decision, but another decision which was recently handed down in a case called West Virginia versus EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, earlier this week, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who represents Michigan's 12th district in Washington, D.C., including many of the communities served by WHFR, issued a statement basically blasting the Supreme Court ruling in this case, West Virginia versus EPA. The Congresswoman says the Supreme Court's decision to restrict the EPA's ability to reduce carbon emissions will set our world back decades, if not more, in the fight to combat global climate change. Stripping the EPA of its ability to keep our air clean sets a dangerous precedent and opens the doors for polluters of all kinds to put profits over the health of our planet. Reading from her statement, the full version of which is available on the Dearborn Press and Guide website, and I imagine on the Congresswoman's website as well. To shed a little more light on this subject of this ruling, one of the most recent rulings handed down by the Supreme Court, we turn to the series Sea Change Radio, a podcast and program made available to us through the Public Radio Exchange. The program, hosted by Alex Wise, features guest Alex Gilbert discussing the West Virginia versus EPA ruling. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to energy expert Alex Gilbert about this recent ruling that many environmentalists are eyeing with dread. To Gilbert, though, things could have gone much, much worse in the case. We'll dive into the details of the ruling, its political ramifications, its practical implications, and what it suggests about the court's future environment-related decisions. Diving deep on West Virginia versus EPA, thanks to Congresswoman Debbie Dingell and her statement on this week's WHFR Journal.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If I were to have created the scenarios of my expected outcomes in this case, this outcome is actually better than my best case outcome. When you look at what could have been done here, the fact that they took a case they probably shouldn't have taken anyways, that was a sign that a lot of people were thinking of very significant changes were coming to environmental law.
It seems like these days, every sentence that begins with the Supreme Court finishes with truly appalling news. Another draconian ruling regarding privacy, guns, or basic fundamental human rights. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to energy expert Alex Gilbert about a recent Supreme Court decision that many environmentalists were eyeing with dread. To Gilbert, though, things could have gone much, much worse in the West Virginia versus EPA case. We dive into the details of this ruling, its political ramifications, its practical implications, and what it suggests about this court's future environment-related decisions. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Alex Gilbert. Alex is the Director of Space and Planetary Regulations at Zeno Power. Alex, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. I appreciate the opportunity to return.
Yes, it's been a while since we've had you. You're an expert in the energy field. This new venture of yours that you're engaged in, Zeno Power, why don't you quickly explain what the Director of Space and Planetary Regulations at Zeno Power does?
Yeah, so we are developing commercial radioisotope power sources. It's similar to a nuclear battery is the best way to think about it. And it's what NASA historically has used to power some of their deep space missions, like the Apollo missions, the Mars rovers, the Voyager missions. And NASA has their systems, but there's a commercial space sector growing right now. And so we're developing commercial space nuclear systems to help enable new applications in space, as well as some things on Earth as well, areas that are very remote, hard to power, that need just a little bit of power to really do cool things.
And there hasn't been any Supreme Court rulings that have affected your business lately, but I know that the rest of the country and a lot of the world has been on tenterhooks as these devastating Supreme Court decisions just roll in one by one. The latest was in the environment, and I wanted to discuss that with you. West Virginia versus the EPA. The headlines were that the Supreme Court handcuffed the EPA, and the reaction of most people was not again, because the Supreme Court has been so destructive on so many issues, this term in particular. Your take on this ruling was a little more optimistic, though. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of concern in the energy and climate policy world about this case. The fact that they took this case in the first place, as I'll talk about, was really weird. It deals with a regulation that's not moving forward, and normally courts don't deal with that. And considering the overall reactionary swing of the court and some of the cases that you've mentioned that have been very controversial, that seem to break established precedent, there was concern that the Supreme Court even taking this case was a sign that they were about to deal a hammer death blow to environmental law generally, not even just climate litigation or regulation, but actually go at some of the fundamental principles underlying environmental law. So when this court case came out today, I think there's been a lot of knee-jerk reaction that, oh, the Supreme Court is clearly cutting down on EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases. The ruling itself is weird, again, because this wasn't the case they would normally take, and it was actually much more narrow than people realize. EPA actually still has very broad authority under this to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and actually opens the door for them to do so with a higher level of legal certainty than they had 2 days ago.
So why did the Supreme Court take this case, and why don't you kind of explain the knee-jerk reaction that some journalists are taking in terms of looking at it through a wider lens?
Yeah, so I'm going to give a brief history here because it helps to understand the context. So the Clean Air Act has its origins in the 1960s. The major Clean Air Act itself was passed in 1970. The last time that we've done major amendments was 1990. And if you look at that compared to some other air pollution issues, that was similar to when we're starting to deal with issues like smog or factory air pollution. And so the Clean Air Act had specific provisions to deal with that type of pollution. But climate change and greenhouse gas emissions was just emerging as a major issue. The first environmental conference itself, Rio, was in 1990. The IPCC was just forming, and the first assessment report was in the 90s. And so the way the Clean Air Act was written did not actually have provisions related to greenhouse gas emissions. Now, that started changing, and things essentially started snowballing in the early 2000s. There was a consideration from the EPA under the Bush administration whether they should look at greenhouse gas emission standards for car vehicles, because the Clean Air Act, under the specific provision there, says they have to look at all air pollutants. They decided not to, and they got sued. And in the 2007 court case, Massachusetts versus EPA, the Supreme Court actually determined that greenhouse gases could be considered an air pollutant if EPA reaches an endangerment finding that they threaten public health and safety. In 2009, it did so, and that led to them starting to regulate greenhouse gases, first for vehicles, then more recently they've done other things like methane, but then under the Obama administration, they looked at doing it for power plants. And this is where it gets to this court case. The Obama administration proposed a regulation called the Clean Power Plan, and the Clean Power Plan looked at how to reduce emissions in the power sector through a number of methods. They did what's called a building block approach, because they were using very specific parts of the Clean Air Act that were meant for when you're regulating something that you didn't know was an issue before. So the Supreme Court, what they've done here is they've looked at that regulation that was withdrawn by the Trump administration, the Biden administration is not pursuing, to see how they were trying to regulate the power sector. And they found that while some parts of how they were doing it were okay, specifically requiring that coal power plants shift generation to natural gas or clean energy sources using that specific part of the Clean Air Act was not okay. So that's really precise. That's a technical procedural thing for a regulation that is not necessarily going into effect right now. EPA still has the ability to regulate greenhouse gases from vehicles. It still has the ability to regulate greenhouse gases from existing power plants. And so that's one of the things when I think a lot of people were concerned that they're actually going to maybe overrule Massachusetts versus EPA or do some other things to make it really hard for EPA to do their job. Whereas what they really did is there was a technical ruling on a regulation.
So, Alex, you tweeted about how the technology in the carbon capture sector has shifted over the last few years, and that kind of informs how we can read this case. In Twitter, you're limited to a number of characters, and so I wanted you to expand on that if you can.
Yeah, so the bottom line for this case is the Obama administration tried to regulate power plant emissions using things, quote, inside the fence line, meaning at a facility, or outside the fence line by shifting generation away. The court said they can't do the second one the way they were planning on doing that. And so if you want to regulate emissions at a power plant now, you've got to look at the facility itself. When the Obama administration first developed the rules, the primary way they thought they can get some emissions reductions is what's called a heat rate improvement, essentially just making your power plant more efficient so you produce more energy per greenhouse gas emitted. You can get some efficiency there, anywhere from 2 to 10% depending on the plant. That's not enough to drive large-scale changes, but that's a fair amount. But at the time the Obama administration did this, there were several other options that they either didn't look at or that were technologically underdeveloped and still being pursued. So one area is carbon capture, where you essentially capture the emissions from a power plant, put it underground, and that way you are not putting that into the atmosphere. At the time the regulation of the Obama administration was first developed in 2013, that technology seemed very immature and expensive. It is still a technology that is not seeing widespread use in the power sector, but we have had a successful retrofit at the Boundary Dam facility in Canada. We also have carbon capture operating in many other sectors. If you were to do that same analysis today, it's a mature technology that is going to be expensive for coal plants, but it is a reasonable control technology that would comply with the Supreme Court's ruling. Another option that has emerged over the past 5 to 8 years is actually converting a coal power plant to run on natural gas. We've actually seen about 100 power plant units around the country have done that over the last 10 years. That's primarily been to reduce local air pollution and toxic air pollution, not greenhouse gases, but it has had greenhouse gas benefits. And the EPA in 2013, when they first looked at this, said this doesn't seem like a feasible option. Because of the shale revolution, because of everything that's happened with natural gas availability, it is. And so the Biden administration can come in and use these three methods: heat rate improvements, carbon capture, and potentially requiring a shift to natural gas to create a relatively stringent greenhouse gas regulation based on this ruling.
No one wins and there's no denying. Don't pretend like you don't know why. Just a little word here, a little push there, darling. I confess.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Alex Gilbert. He's the Director of Space and Planetary Regulations at Zeno Power. So, Alex, when we're talking about this West Virginia versus EPA case, it sounds like it's not just the media that is painting the ruling with a broad brush. The Biden administration also has looked at it as a negative ruling. Biden said himself that it was devastating and it aimed to move the U.S., quote, backward in the climate fight. So what is the president missing here? How are they misinterpreting this so egregiously?
Well, frankly, I think what they're doing is playing good politics. The Supreme Court, as we've talked about, has had this very reactionary bent lately. It's had many issues that are impacting immigrant communities, women's rights, tribal communities. And this is showing, again, that the court is potentially hostile to environmental groups. So while the ruling itself is relatively narrow and specific, there are concerns that in the longer term, this could show how the court would rule on similar environmental cases. But really, this is, in some ways, a political gift to the administration, because they could say, this is a radical court. It is something that is it's consistent with the rest of their messaging and their political goals, while at the same time, the ruling itself doesn't overly constrain what they can do policy-wise. And so in some ways, this is kind of the best of the both worlds, considering what could have happened had there been a much more aggressive ruling.
So is it a gift to the president, or is it maybe an ominous sign of things to come?
I think there are concerns generally about how this court would handle environmental cases. There's enough support here that a circuit court will probably uphold a number of greenhouse gas regulations in the power sector, in other sectors. If you do a similar program in the future, there's definitely going to be Supreme Court review. But if you look at this, both this case and the most recent greenhouse gas case at the Supreme Court, UARG versus EPA, which was also a conservative panel, there is some support to push back on environmental regulations, but not necessarily completely get rid of them. Ultimately, though, when you look at what we have, the tools we have under the Clean Air Act, they are not sufficient to deal with what we need to do on the climate change question. The Clean Air Act is a blunt instrument for dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. We will use it if we need to, because we must reduce emissions as fast as possible, as much as possible. But it is no substitute for action by Congress, for action by state governments, and for the private sector to play a role here. So the court and legal approach, the regulatory approach to try and deal with greenhouse gases under existing legal authorities, it's a ball game worth playing. It's one that is always going to be an uphill battle, and it's going to be slow. We need to take this moment to say we should try and redouble these efforts. We must continue them. But we also need to recognize that this avenue is never going to be how we're going to solve the climate challenge. We need to have national legislation. We need to have other solutions besides a regulatory approach through the Clean Air Act.
So in her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said that, quote, whatever else this court may know about, it does not have a clue about how to address climate change. So she was worried that the ruling is saying that the courts and the Congress should ultimately be legislating environmental regulations, not the Environmental Protection Agency. Do you see it that way, Alex?
Yeah, I think what that is hinting at is one of the underlying tensions here between the conservative and liberal justices on the court. When you look at the fundamental root of the statutory issue here, the issue is that the Clean Air Act did not have specific directions to EPA on how to handle greenhouse gas emissions. It had general guidance for how to deal with air pollutants. So a lot of the litigation and back and forth that's happening is over interpretations of, frankly, terms that are somewhat ambiguous. For different cases, the word air pollutant, depending on where it is in the Clean Air Act, can mean different things, and that leads to different regulatory umbrellas. In terms of what Justice Kagan was talking about, in looking at how this is applied in practice, I think that there's a big difference between the liberal and the conservative wings of the court on what powers Congress has actually given to the EPA. And I think that that's part of the challenge here, is there's an ambiguity. There's one reading where they've given the EPA broad powers and discretion to deal with this. There's another reading where to do something that is as intensive as regulating the whole power sector will require much more specific statutory authorizations. I think one thing that you're sensing too with the ruling here is that the EPA has a clear directive to regulate new things that have come up that are not in the Clean Air Act, like greenhouse gas emissions. How they do that, though, is not as clear. And I think that the conservative wing is pushing back on that how to a certain degree, because they don't see guidance in the statute itself, and they see that Congress is not acting on this. I think there's a number of things here, too, the broader questions about textualism versus an evolving constitution, the role of the regulatory state, that are going back and forth in these discussions between the justices.
So you mentioned Congress. I thought it was pretty rich for the conservative wing of the court to be referencing Congress as having the legislative authority in this when they've done so much to strip Congress of its powers recently, you know, kicking everything back to the states. How do you see it playing forward in future cases that could be analogous to this West Virginia versus EPA case?
Well, one thing that was odd about the conservative opinion in this case that I actually found really concerning is that they pointed to Congress's inability to pass a cap-and-trade system as a sign of congressional intent when they wrote the Clean Air Act decades ago. I think that's inappropriate, and I think what they're doing is essentially twisting some facts to what they wanted to rule on. The fact that Congress has new legislation that has not moved forward on an issue actually does not bear on a different Congress from decades ago and what their legislative intent was. And I think there is no ambiguity that the Congress that passed the Clean Air Act of 1970 and the amendments in 1990 wanted EPA to have the ability to deal with new issues. They wanted EPA as the expert agency to address new air pollutants, to be able to handle new things that are arising without Congress always having to step in. And so just because Congress hasn't done anything on this for the last 15, 20, 30 years, that is not the basis to do what the court has been doing for some of their interpretations. I think moving forward, there are broader questions about if Congress can pass a greenhouse gas cap and trade system or a carbon tax, how might the court rule on that? I think if you look at what the court has been doing here, this is for most of the justices, a relatively moderate case outcome. They could have been much more aggressive. They could have done something like say that greenhouse gases are not a pollutant or you do not have the ability to look at this. But if Congress does do something like that, it will likely have a challenge that could go to the Supreme Court. And I think the concern here is that you have six justices now that might vote to strip Congress of certain authorities there. It is uncertain what that looks like. I think depending if you're doing a cap and trade or carbon tax system, there could be different legal justifications. But in terms of the regulatory state, the only way that Congress, I think, can address this specific question of the Clean Air Act is Congress needs to be specific about Clean Air Act authorities related to greenhouse gas emissions, whether that is some policy mechanism, whether that is a direct broad grant of authority to give Congress the ability to handle or give EPA the ability to handle all these things that Congress wants it done. Unless you can get to a really high degree of legal certainty, the Supreme Court will be a big stumbling block. And I think the other thing, too, is beyond Congress, for the executive branch, the Biden administration, they're going to be much more wary developing rulemakings now moving forward when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. Whereas before, they might try and be very aggressive, say, under the Obama administration, the Clean Power Plan. Anything that they do develop is going to be really close to what they think that can get past legal muster right now, because they'll probably expect that the court is going to be more likely than not to take up major greenhouse gas cases in the future.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Alex Gilbert. He's the Director of Space and Planetary Regulations at Zeno Power. So, Alex, you mentioned how this West Virginia versus EPA case, the majority opinion did not do some of the things that we feared, such as saying that the EPA would not have the purview over emissions in general, or that greenhouse gas emissions are not harmful to the environment, etc. And I know this is a long opinion and it just came out, so you're not responsible for having read every word of it. But are you aware of any sidebars from Alito or Thomas in terms of something along that lines, that a climate change denial type rhetoric?
Yeah, so the majority opinion here was decided on by six justices, and then the other three justices dissented. Gorsuch and Alito had a concurring opinion, which means that they agreed with the overall majority opinion, but they also had other thoughts they wanted to expand on. And that's where they actually looked in depth, not so much at the climate change implications, but on questions related to regulatory state and administrative law. They essentially are
building out what they call the major questions doctrine. So the way that most environmental law administrative law works right now is based on the Chevron doctrine, which was decided in 1984, which gives judicial deference to agencies when a statute isn't ambiguous. Basically means that if Congress writes something and it's kind of unclear what it says, if the agency has a reasonable analysis and not a justifiable case for what they think it says and they regulate on that basis, courts will defer to that. Agencies are specialists and courts acknowledge that they're not. The major questions doctrine, I think what they're trying to do here is lay the foundation to either overturn the Chevron doctrine or provide a lot more critical judicial review of the Chevron doctrine. What that means in practice, it's really loosely defined. It's something that they are creating essentially in real time. It's not founded based on originalist or textualist philosophy. It's essentially the idea that when it comes to a major question, a major issue of public policy, something that you would normally expect Congress to weigh in on, if Congress hasn't weighed in on it and been specific about it and has just given vague authority to regulatory agencies, then the major questions doctrine will say that you actually can't regulate on that. Even if Congress says that, like EPA, you have broad authority to address new pollutants that might arise, and that might apply to greenhouse gases, the major questions doctrine says greenhouse gases, they're a very national concern. They impact all parts of the economy. And if EPA regulates them, it's going to have a lot of implications for industry and society, and a lot of economic implications as well. And so it is something that it's a doctrine that's in development. I think that if you talk to most legal scholars, there's a very weak case for it being found in American traditional thought throughout history. I think part of it is they are trying to reverse Chevron doctrine because that gives a lot of power to regulatory agencies and the executive branch. So that's the biggest thing that I would flag there, is that they're kind of setting up this major questions doctrine. So in the future, if there are other major regulations, whether outside of environmental law or in environmental law, that have wide-ranging consequences and some level of statutory ambiguity, the court might well be in a position to strike that down. I think the thing about this case that struck me is that you were only able to get Gorsuch and Alito to join that major questions doctrine concurrence. That makes me likely think that not having, say, Thomas on there makes me think that if you look at future cases, there's not enough as much appetite to necessarily invoke that doctrine to overturn major parts of law. So it seems like the court is not going to be willing to step in and say EPA reaches an endangerment finding, but we don't think that endangerment finding is appropriate and we're overturning that. That doesn't seem like where the court is heading. It seems more likely what they're trying to do is limit the ability to do new ambitious things, not necessarily things that have been done previously.
And to be clear, I mean, we're still talking about government regulations, whether it be from Congress or the EPA. But what's the political reality is that right now the White House is democratically controlled. And so the EPA is the instrument of that administration. If the House of Representatives should flip to the Republican majority in the fall, then that would be a new political reality for enforcing these regulations. That's kind of at the heart of it in my interpretation. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that is underlying a lot of the judicial and legal history here. One of the issues that led to this case is that the Clean Power Plan developed by the Obama administration was withdrawn by the Trump administration. The Trump administration created their own, which would have been very weak and would have been subject to environmental challenges, would have also gone through the courts. Then the Biden administration withdrew that. And so the fact that the court took this case in the first place is just kind of weird, because it was dealing with a regulation that is several regulations ago. It's not moving forward. It's not clear if the next EPA, the next administration, will keep up with that. The rulemaking process, depending on how it's done, takes 2 to 5 years. And on top of that, you're going to have judicial review afterwards. So you need to have an 8-year period, really a 2-term period, to be able to develop the regulation, to be able to get it through several rounds of legal review and defend it before it becomes law, before another administration can come in, or potentially Congress can come in and try and push back against it. So again, when you look at this, it's always important to remember that the Clean Air Act, the regulatory system, it is a tool in the box, but we always knew we were going to need something more. And this is just showing why it's not a good tool. The process here started in 2003 when the EPA first looked at whether greenhouse gases apply for vehicles. It's 2022. vehicles have some standards. We haven't gotten to power plants yet. We haven't gotten to refineries. We haven't got to a whole host of greenhouse gas emitters. It's a slow-moving, long-term process. And if we don't reach our climate goals, it's not going to be because the Supreme Court is preventing the EPA from being the Clean Air Act regulator. It's going to be because we have not had a sufficient top-level federal climate bill that gets us moving in the right direction, that provides clear, unambiguous statutory authority to EPA or other agencies to address this problem.
But for climate hawks like yourself, reading this EPA versus West Virginia case, you said that it felt like a opinion from 6 years ago. And is it fair to characterize that you felt a little bit of relief that there was a bullet that was slightly dodged?
Absolutely. If I were to have created the scenarios of my expected outcomes in this case, this outcome is actually better than my best case outcome. When you look at what could have been done here, the fact that they took a case they probably shouldn't have taken anyways, that was a sign that a lot of people were thinking of very significant changes were coming to environmental law. The actual ruling here, it's very specific to Section 111D regulation of existing sources for new types of emissions. And even then, it's only specifically tailored to the Clean Power Plan. So if you do a 111D regulation in the future for a different sector, it's not actually clear that this regulation provides binding precedent for what you're trying to do. It's a really narrow technical reading. One of the things that I think happened here is that when the court was first looking at taking this case, you had five justices that might have wanted to do something more ambitious, excluding Roberts. I think that they might have wanted to maybe done something to really change administrative law. And I think as this case got argued, because there were a lot of people that sent in amicus briefs that tried to make broader arguments, including the government, about whether this is even a moot case to consider, I think that Roberts was able to work with the other justices, get several of the justices that might have wanted to do something more ambitious, and tame down that ruling to make it very procedural, make it very narrow. But whether that's the case in the future, whether that would apply to other case law for environment or climate change, who knows? This is a court that will generally be skeptical of greenhouse gas regulations under the existing Clean Air Act. It's a court that will be generally skeptical of environmental law. But what happened here is I think that the case itself could have been much worse. I'm breathing a sigh of relief right now, and I think there is a pathway forward for continued greenhouse gas regulations under this precedent.
Alex Gilbert, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks again for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by O'Donnell Levy, The English Beat, and The Beatles.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
That's all we have time for on today's WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. On behalf of Susan McGraw, we thank you for spending this hour with us here on WHFR Making Waves. We hope you'll continue to do so as Kitty Love comes up next, Highway 61. Some blues for your Friday afternoon. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 FM, online at WHFR.FM, Making Waves. Mexico.